John Ronson is the author of the bestsellers The Psychopath Test, Loss at Sea, Then, and The Men Who Stare at Goats. From psychopaths to suicide cults, military psychics to human superheroes, he has immersed himself in bizarre and terrifying worlds and become master of what John Stewart coined to describe his prose, investigative satire. In his new book, So You've Been Publicly Shamed, Ronson investigates the world of public shaming, where social media has made everyone a vigilante, and where a poorly phrased tweet or comment can catapult a person to public enemy number one overnight. The name of the book is So You've Been Publicly Shamed, and it's a great pleasure to welcome John Ronson back to the program. John, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you so much.
It's very nice to have you back on the show. The last time we spoke was when the book first came out, and I guess it's safe to say that over the past year, not much has happened in the issue of shaming.
I know, everything went quiet after my book came out. It's funny, actually, for a few weeks after my book came out, there were some editorials like, John Ronson's book and Monica Lewinsky's TED Talk are going to change everything. You know, it's going to make us much more holistic when it comes to judging other people's failings and transgressions. And then the dentist killed the lion and everything went back to normal. And shaming's just increased unbelievably over the past year. It got to like an epidemic level.
Give us a sense of how you decided to investigate the world of public shaming, because this did come out somewhat of personal experience.
Sure. Well, I mean, it started in part because some academics created a John Ronson spam bot on Twitter that was kind of tweeting nonsense and being followed by people that I knew from real life. And so I kind of publicly shamed them. I didn't realize that's what I was doing, but I interviewed them and put the video out on YouTube, and the YouTube comments were so vicious. I mean, calling for their death. And I went very quickly from feeling thrilled, like I was Braveheart, to feeling like I was the head of a pitchfork mob, and that was a strange feeling. And I think what I realized is that my whole career I've been writing about cults, about extreme behavior in the margins of society, political extremists, religious extremists, people abusing their power, like all the way over there. And it dawned on me that the crazy people abusing their power now was us. And it was coming to a large extent from a good place. It was coming from a place of compassion and social justice, but it was turning brutal and fascinatingly brutal and dangerous, and I think that's why I wanted to write this book.
So let's look at various sides of the equation here. In to begin with, why would someone want to be so brutal? Why would somebody want to be in a position to do something that could destroy a person, destroy an aspect of a person's life?
Well, I mean, I think there's a whole bunch of things going on, and there's different sorts of shamings. I mean, some people are misogynists who want to tear apart feminists for their own weird, colorful, misogynistic reasons. And I think for the purposes of this book, I was less interested in people like that because they're a kind of outrageous, clownish minority. I was more interested in nice people like us who do it for compassionate reasons, who do it for what they think is kind of social justice reasons, but what it really is a kind of, as somebody wrote about my book, it's about a kind of cathartic alternative to social justice, pulling some person out of a crowd and, you know, making them responsible for systemic failings because of some joke they told on Twitter that came out badly is not social justice. What it is this kind of weird redefining of a human being. I mean, I'll give you an example. Probably the most famous story in my book is this woman, Justine Sacco, who tweeted just before getting on a plane, she tweeted, "Going to Africa, hope I don't get AIDS, just kidding, I'm white." And then while she slept on a plane and unable to explain that her joke was intended to mock privilege, Twitter just dismantled her life, got her fired, stigmatized, you know, put her into terrible mental ill health. And a whole bunch of things were going on there. I mean, to a large extent, it was a case of kind of performance piety, like people wanted to show the people who followed them on Twitter that they were compassionate people who cared about people dying of AIDS in Africa. So it was the desire to be compassionate that led a lot of people to committing this profoundly uncompassionate act. But there was also a hell of a lot of hipsters got involved. You know, Justine's shaming was a shaming that many disparate groups could get behind, misogynists, hipsters, and so on. And I think it's partly because social media is this kind of mutual approval machine where we just approve each other all the time. But what nobody factored in was the fact that it was an agonizing experience for people like Justine. So I wanted to write a kind of horror movie of a book. You know, reading my book's like watching the Blair Witch Project. It gives you a kind of terrible anxiety attack because I wanted people to feel the agony that we're inflicting on others.
And, of course, she has responsibility as well for writing it. And shouldn't people be aware and have a responsibility that what they write is going to be open to interpretation and can be dissected?
Well, honestly, in Justine's case, I take a slightly radically empathetic position. Sure, it was a terrible combination of words. But she had 170 Twitter followers. The New York Times ran an extract from my book, and when the fact checker phoned Justine up and said, you know, so were you surprised that, you know, before you got on the plane, were you surprised that nobody responded to your joke? She said, nobody ever responded to any of my jokes. She was like a comedian telling jokes in an empty room. So she could never have anticipated that while she was asleep on a plane, she would become the worldwide number one trending topic on Twitter. You know, for a couple of days afterwards, when you type the word Justine into Google, you get Justine Sacco before you get Justin Bieber. That's how famous Justine got for a while. She went from 40 Google hits a month to 1,220,000 Google hits. And also, the other thing about Justine was that nobody allowed her the chance to explain the joke. She was asleep on a plane while the whole thing happened. I love the fact that Justine's a kind of uncomfortable, difficult story. I've written a new chapter about all the terrible things that have happened since the book came out. And I say that, you know, an unfashionable, wronged person is still a wronged person. And I think that's what Justine was.
John Ronson is our guest. The name of the book is So You've Been Publicly Shamed. When it comes to the comment that sets off, though, and I think you make a case on Justine's behalf, but there are a lot of times where the person who writes the original message does have to take responsibility for that.
Sure, absolutely. I mean, I didn't really want to write a book about people like that. You know, there was a case in England a couple of days ago. I always know this because people who are annoyed with me for defending people like Justine Sacco always bring me in to stories about much worse transgressions. So, like, if a racist cop shoots somebody, I get a bunch of tweets. Because I defended Justine, I get a bunch of tweets along the lines of, you know, waiting for John Ronson to put his cape on for this person, which you can imagine is you know, distressing and hurtful. A couple of days ago, some guy in England did a series of racist tweets about Muslims. And a few people were like, oh, are you going to support him like you supported Justine Sacco? But that completely misses the point of the book, because my book is about nuance and Twitter kind of hates nuance. And I wouldn't, like, you know, if Justine Sacco was some kind of racist, some kind of Tea Party racist, I wouldn't have put her in the book. I wanted to write a book about the disproportionate punishment of people who hadn't done anything much wrong. And racists have done something wrong.
When it comes to that idea of public shaming and the actual comments and what Justine and others have received in the comments, I mean, we can say that she is responsible for what she said, but of course, those who respond should also be responsible for what they say. And that's where it seems to be an unlevel playing field, correct?
Yeah, and particularly because some of the things levelled at Justine Saka were way worse than what Justine said. I mean, one person that night tweeted, I hope you can, they tweeted, somebody HIV positive should rape this and then we'll find out if her skin colour protects her from AIDS. And guess how many people went after that person? Nobody. That person got a free pass.
What do you think it is, and I know I asked this earlier, but I'm curious as to, in your dissection of this, of what it is that compels people to have that moment to be as vicious as they possibly can be. And I guess to understand, as you said, that there's that moment that you can take the social high road and say, I responded to this great injustice in the world and have other people see it. But I will say that in reading the comment sections after articles on public newspaper pages and of course, tweets and other comments that people have on Facebook pages and so forth, it is really to the point where you feel awful about the society you live in.
Yeah, absolutely. I noticed a few weird psychological tricks that we play on ourselves when we take part in shamings like this. Quite recently, I just read a book called Moral Disengagement by the great psychologist Albert Bandura, and he actually lists in this book the various psychological tricks we play on ourselves to not feel bad about the bad things we do. And it was all the things I noticed when I was writing So You've Been Publicly Shamed. So one is moral justifications. You know, we give our bad behavior a moral justification. And Bandura actually paints that as a particularly bad psychological trick, because when we're doing things for what we perceive to be a higher moral reason, everything gets heightened. We're angrier and we feel less anticipatory guilt. Then we also use dehumanizing language. The night of the Justine Sacco shaming, a whole bunch of people were tweeting, her father is the billionaire mining baron Desmond Sacco, so I don't feel sorry for the daughter of a billionaire. And I just assumed that was true about Justine until I met her in a bar a couple of weeks later and I asked her about her billionaire father, and she looked at me like I was nuts and she said, my father's a carpet salesman. So, you know, we use dehumanizing language like daughter of a billionaire or sociopath or whatever. So that's another trick that we pull on ourselves.
And what do you think the person who is writing it, the shamer, what are they personally getting out of it, and are they ever shamed in response?
That does happen. I tell a really shocking story in So You've Been Publicly Shamed about these two guys called Hank and Alex who were in a conference in Santa Clara whispering a joke. One of them whispered a joke to the other about big dongles, like Beavis and Butthead. Big dongles. So the woman sitting in front takes a photograph of them and tweets it. So their photograph, without their knowledge, tweeted with the caption, not cool, jokes about big dongles right behind me. So one of them gets fired from his job. And so she's perceived, rightly, I would say, as being an inappropriate shamer. And what happens to her? She's hugely inappropriately shamed. She gets rape threats. She gets death threats. She loses her job. She has to go into hiding. You know, this really speaks to a kind of paucity of imagination. All we can think to do with bad shamings is shame the shamers badly. That, you know, we have to get out of that. And the way to get out of it is to be curious about people and compassionate about people.
One of the things that seems to be a bit of a misunderstanding, a myth, if you will, is that, at least in reading your book, that people can get over this very easily, that it goes by quickly.
Exactly. That's another psychological trick that Albert Bandura writes about in Moral Disengagement. It's denying, in the face of evidence to the contrary, that there's any bad consequence to our harmful actions. Time and again, when I was writing So You've Been Publicly Shamed, I'd say to shamers, how do you think that person is now? And they'd reply, oh, I'm sure they're fine. But they're not sad. I mean, people kill themselves. And if they don't kill themselves, they certainly entertain suicidal thoughts. They have anxiety, depression, insomnia. But we play that trick on ourselves. I'm sure they're fine.
In your research, is that we've just given the tools, the technological tools to do so, or does this follow a path of a long line of public shaming?
Well, you know, the reason why... Okay, so I went up to the Massachusetts archive to try and work out why public punishments died out in the 19th century. And I didn't find any documents that said we might as well stop the pillory and the stocks because, like, it doesn't do any good, doesn't do anything. Like, you know, the pilloried person just loses himself in the crowd and there's no problem. What I did find was, like, a huge number of documents that said we have to stop these public punishments. They're way too brutal. You know, they're stigmatizing people. The punishment is disproportionate to the crime. You know, if we're going to carry on whipping people, let's whip them in private, not in public, because it's the public nature of the punishment that's more painful and damaging than the whipping itself. So people like Benjamin Rush, who were against public punishments, they prevailed and public punishments did die out. And now they're back with a vengeance. And it's not just about bad behavior on Twitter. When you think about this, this sort of cold, instant, judgmental, you know, milieu that we create on social media, it's kind of seeping out all over the place. It's seeping out onto university campuses. It's seeping out into mainstream politics. It's seeping out into the mainstream media, who were pretty bad anyway, but now they love to re-shame people who were shamed on Twitter. It's kind of setting a new agenda.
So let us talk about the elephant in the room, and that is the fact that we have a front runner in the Republican Party, Donald Trump, who uses Twitter as a way of publicly shaming, as well as to cut down people in any belief that he feels has been wronged in some way. We see this on many levels throughout our society. I think it takes a lot of us a little getting used to believe that a serious contender for the White House is doing this.
Yeah, is a Twitter troll. I mean, not only is it terrible in itself, but the other thing that I find, you know, upsetting about all of this is, you know, when somebody like Donald Trump comes along, everybody's positions harden. So everybody has to take a more entrenched, unnuanced, hardened stance. So he's not only a destructive figure in himself, but he creates a destructive society on the right and on the left. And you see this happening everywhere in society at the moment. As I say, you see it happening on university campuses where you have these kind of, you know, battles between the safe space people and the free speech people. You see it on social media. You see it in the mainstream media. You know, everybody's positions are hardening.
Is it, and I, one of my big worries in looking at this unfold, at least in the presidential campaign, is that once you have hit this low, if you will, how do you ever elevate the platform again?
Well, I mean, I like to think it comes in waves. And, you know, I'm a sort of standard bearer for the nuanced middle ground, which feels like an increasingly marginalized place to be, because nuance and gray areas in the middle ground are now seen to be kind of weak, like weakness. It's a weakness to wait for the plane to land and hear what Justine Sacco has to say about her joke. You know, everything is now, you know, nuance, waiting for evidence, context, you know, moderation is now considered a weakness. But, you know, I like to think it comes in waves and that, you know, when things get as extreme as they are with Donald Trump, the new wave comes along and the new wave is, you know, nuanced moderateness.
The name of the book is So You've Been Publicly Shamed. It is now available in paperback from Riverhead. John Ronson, it's always a great pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you very much for being with us.
It was great talking to you. Thank you so much, Joe.
So again, the name of the book is So You've Been Publicly Shamed. It is published by Riverhead. John Ronson is the author. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.